Welcome to the Buyer's Desk, your weekly resource for all things natural food retail.
This season, we're shaking things up with shorter weekly episodes to fit your busy schedule.
Each month, we dive into SPINS data, explore trends with industry leaders, spotlight emerging brands, and share actionable strategies to help you thrive.
Get ready to explore the world of natural food retail. Hi, and welcome to The Buyer's Desk, an infra podcast. I'm Angela Bozo, Director of Member Programs, and I am joined today by my friend, Nathan Aldridge. He is the Manager of Education at Gourmet Foods International, a distributor based out of Atlanta, Georgia. Nathan, how's it going today?
Hey, Angela. It's going quite well. Thank you.
Excellent. So our theme this month is merchandising, and I do want to talk to you a little bit about broad merchandising, but I think it would be great if we teed up a little bit, like through the manager of education at GFI, like tell me a little bit about what you do.
Excellent. Yeah. So I work with all of our customers in a sense that, if you work with GFI, you get education in cheese and charcuterie, merchandising, shop operations, and product knowledge. Those are the areas that I really hit, and this is my 20th year in specialty food retail, so I've been around a little bit. I started at a mom and pop, helped it grow into a massive cheese beast, so to speak. So my point of view really comes from everything from a very tiny, so let's say 250 square foot shop, to really merchandising those huge 80,000 square foot grocery stores. But other than that, what I do is, you know, of course, teaching product knowledge, wine pairings, beer pairings, but teaching people how to sell and actually how to merchandise a cheese shop to make it really excel in your deli.
So this makes so much sense to me, right? Like a distributor and a retailer have this symbiotic relationship where at the end of the day, we both just want to move product. And it feels to me like, of course, a distributor, GFI strikes me as like standing out in the marketplace as particularly high touch. But it just makes like when you lay it out in this, like, I'll teach you how to sell the product that we both want sold. I don't actually have a question there. I just think it makes so much sense.
Thank you. I agree. I think it's perfect. It's a match made in heaven, so to speak.
All right. So you kind of teed me up to ask you a couple of questions about like cases at scale. So let's start with that 250 square foot cheese case. Tell me a little bit about how you specifically look at curation and merchandising when we're really limited on the set that we have in the store.
Well, when I'm looking at, you know, especially merchandising cheese, and you could probably take this into other products, but there are certain products that, whether you want to deem them gourmet, upscale, artisanal, some items to me require a little bit more of a story and require somebody behind the counter, so to speak, like a cheesemonger, to actually speak about that product, taste it with the customer, you know, something, introduce something new. And for that, you know, I'm looking at cases that are accessible from the front and back, cases that will allow you to be able to merchandise cheese, to recreate the shape of the wheel, to have some fun merchandising. And that's on the opposite end of those cheeses that are still delicious, but may not require such a big story to tell, you know, that people already know. I'm like Irish cheddar or Jarlsberg, Havarti, all wonderful products, you know, that we love to sell, but those don't really sit in needing a big story or needing a massive display because customers are already going to seek those out. So to me, like it's fine to divide up your cheese into, say, like a 5-deck case that's easily shoppable, or a coffin case, so to speak, that's also easily shoppable, but that's separated away from the other cheeses if that's what you have the room for, if that makes sense.
Yeah, you know, that's actually a really interesting way to think about it. In grocery, you know, in center store, if I know that something's selling, I might give it more facings because it's selling. But in cheese, if I'm going to seek it out, I might limit that number of facings, knowing that a customer would do the work, and then put something that I really want to introduce someone to in like a more prominent position, which feels a little different than what we would do in grocery, but makes total sense.
No, absolutely. And with cheese in particular, of course, you're going to want to fit. I mean, you don't need every cheese in the world. But once you've sat down as a buyer or a category manager or as a manager and thought, okay, here's my idea of a perfect cheese set. You know, which of course entails a lot of work because you're going to need cheeses from each and every category, from different ages, different milk types. So once you get that well-rounded, you're going to see that you're going to need a fair amount of space. So if you have enough space in your cheese shop to put three or four facings of one cheese out, to me, that means you've got room for more cheese. That means that you can actually create a little bit more variety. And cheese is one of those areas in your store that I think more variety is going to help out. Sometimes you can go through SKU rationalization and, you know, hey, I've got too many SKUs of pita chips. Yeah, you don't really need 17 different styles of pita chips, but you may need 10 different styles of cheddar because an English cloth-bound cheddar is different than an Irish cheddar that's different than a Montemore cheddar from Sartori with a different culture added to it, you know? So then different customers are going to be searching for different things, like a Beecher's cheddar that can melt, that you can cook with. So all of those things, to me, you have to take into account when dealing with cheese. And I find that when I talk with retailers, especially independent markets, a lot of the mindset is, I've got these cheeses, they sell, I have very little shrink, I don't need to do more. And I'm like, well, wait a minute. This happened last week. I was out of town traveling. And I was talking to an independent store owner, and I think they have six stores across the Northeast, beautiful, lovely little stores, all clean items that they have in there. But they were really proud of the fact that they had zero shrink. And when dealing with perishables, zero shrink is actually bad. Zero shrink tells me you are not doing anything to innovate, not doing anything to try to bring in more products or try to sell something new to your customers. It means, hey, I'm complacent. I'm happy with where I am. I don't want to grow anymore. So challenge yourself. You know, you can still, you know, I'm not trying to get you to get a lot of shrink, right? But you don't know what your customers want until you offer them something else. And the way that the cheese and charcuterie world are growing, you know, with the advent now of social media, and charcuterie boards are so hot right now, people are actively looking out for more things. So excuse me if I'm long-winded to say, bring in more items, try new products. It's okay.
Oh, no, I love it. Please feel free to be as long-winded as you would like, because no, you're making some really interesting points here, right? Because again, with that grocery mindset, if I'm like, nope, everything in my case is selling, I am absolutely like doing the thing that the customer needs me to do. To your point, it could get really boring after some time. And the customer maybe would find that thing on social media or find some more interesting varietal. And then they'll sort of, I don't know if the word I'm looking for is learn, but they'll internalize this. I find innovation and interesting SKUs elsewhere. And that seems to be a challenge. I also feel like, though, there's this really interesting challenge of, yes, of course, we don't want anyone to get too much shrink. We want to keep the things that we know the customer is selling. Let's just say, hypothetically, taking your cheddar example. So I've got this fantastic 4 feet of cheddar. I've got a couple of different states and countries represented. That's going well. Are you recommending that I build in more cheddar, or are you finding cheddar adjacencies, or are we just going to go more hard cheese? Or like, just give me a little bit of an example of how you would walk me through like innovating a set that is very cheddar heavy.
If you already have a cheddar heavy set, which quite frankly, most people do, because most people are comfortable with cheddar. Cheddar is, you know, number two cheese in the United States in production behind mozzarella, right?
Yeah, pizza! So
I slashing out some facts here. No, but people, like, it's your comfort zone, and that's fine. But the problem is it's your comfort zone and not necessarily your customer's comfort zone. I see time and time again, buyers is like, well, I like this cheese, so I'm going to carry it. That's great. That's wonderful. But what about the cheeses you don't like that somebody else does like? So I would start with my cheddars, and I would start really with country. I would start here and say, I want to make sure I've got English, Irish, American. Those are your big country, your big cheddar producers right there. And with that, look at your different texture profiles. What are different about English cheddars versus Irish cheddars versus American cheddars? England, tell you what, that's the old school. You're going back to traditional cloth bound, stronger, drier cheddars, you know, that are really, quite honestly, more for snacking than for cooking with the can, but those good full bodied, you know, cheddars. Then you go to Ireland, and I find most Irish cheddars are generally mild and grassy, because in Ireland, most cows are completely grass-fed. They're out on fields, and the cheesemakers there want to showcase that freshness, and they want that to come through in the flavor of their cheese. So great, you got that. And then in the States, here in the States, we've got no rules. I think people realize that, is that our cheesemakers have free reign to do whatever we want. And one of the big things that's happening in cheddar and in cheese, or cheddar particularly here in the States, is that our cheesemakers here are trying to innovate their cheeses by using different styles of cultures. So you could see a cheddar cheese with a Parmesan culture. An example of that, you know, just there are some cheeses out there in Wisconsin, like Sartori Montemore. I mentioned that earlier just because I think it's more well known, but they use a cheddar, but they use Parmesan culture, the Parmesan culture that they use for their Parmesans. You also see some cheesemakers in Wisconsin throwing in Gruyere cultures with cheddar cheese. So you're getting, you go anywhere from, and the cultures that they use could also make a cheddar more sweet versus more savory. So those are the flavor profiles that I would go through and look at different age groups. Like, what do people do with cheddar? Some people want to just slice it off, a good yellow New York cheddar that's a year old that they can put with a slice of an apple. Great. But you can have that, and that's different enough from an Irish cheddar that's different enough from an English cheddar. But I wouldn't really go past, I mean, if you've got more than 10 cheddars in your case, you're probably a little over skewed there. Why not use some of that room? So like we said earlier, some of those adjacent cheeses, some of those cheeses that are a little firmer, but yet a little bit different. So that's basically how I would start. And from there, I would want to look at all the categories that I have and see what is more minimal than others. And another category that's a lot of times over skewed, it's the Italian category, which is great. And Italian kind of, it's weird. You could go by cheese styles or you can categorize by country. More often than not, people go by cheese styles and then Italian is all like lumped in together. You know, but, you know, a good provolone versus fontina, all of those are great, but you need to look at your sales numbers and see what you're missing out on there. And I feel like most people could pull back on one or two Italian cheeses to really open up the case for some other things. But I would really have to look at your cheese case. That's part of what I do. Like, that is part of my job. Besides training people about cheese, I walk stores with owners and buyers, and we take a look at your category. And like, I can look at your case just through all the experience that I have and seeing hundreds of chains across this country over the last 20 years. I can help you take a look and say, you know what, you don't have enough wash rind cheeses in your case. Or what's been happening to me lately, is where's your American artisan section? That's something that I feel like is really growing, especially with the advent now of the charcuterie board popularity on social media, is people are looking for more cheeses. And we're starting to see more of that patriotism coming out, where people are looking to support your American producers. And we have so many new, wonderful American cheese producers out there that some of them are bound to be local to you. Wherever you are, whoever's listening out there, know that somewhere nearby is a farm with animals that is producing milk that's going to make cheese that you should be selling in your case.
Yeah, you know, the American artisan producer, you said it, and I remember when I learned this, the whole, in Europe, you know, there's a lot of constraints around various, like a lot of specificity around how cheeses are made. And in America, it's like, yeah, we just want to do it this way. We're not beholden by the same standards, which is innovative and interesting. And I think sometimes actually really challenging for the cheese consumer, because then an American producer might be making something either very unique or just called something obscure that doesn't like ground them in a, this is actually like if I took a camembert and combined it with a, I don't know, pick something else. Right. And so I do find that to be fascinating. And I also find it to be an interesting challenge if you were going to create an entire case by, to your point, like varietal, American artisan producers are going to have a little bit of a weird time fitting into that. So, you know, honestly, all of that, again, I don't necessarily have a question. I just think that it's like an interesting way to look at that set, right? When in grocery, we might think about it in terms of subcategory. We very infrequently look at country of origin, but we want to make sure that we have kind of like all the things, like all the basics that you would need. And in a cheese case, tell me, like, has anybody ever asked you for a core set? What does a core set of cheese look like?
Oh my goodness. Yes. The short answer is yeah. People do ask for a core set of cheese, which is great. But that question to me right now is like when I'm a cheesemonger, when I'm on the counter and a customer asks me what should they put on their cheese board. It's a great question. I'm absolutely going to help you with that, but it's not going to be a short answer. We're going to walk through it and I'm going to ask you a lot of questions back. Because it depends on where you are in the country. You know, you have to know your market. You have to know your customers. And going back to the very beginning of our conversation, you have to know what sells, but you also have to know what your employees are capable of. Besides just knowing what you're going to sell, like, do you have customer service? Or do you have enough hours in your stores to provide customer service, to do demos, to have somebody there to answer questions? If that answer is yes, then man, that really opens your door to your core set. And I think, not to take too much away from this, but it's also like I ask a guy looking to get my windows replaced in the house. I'm like, what's the average cost of getting your windows replaced? And he's like, that depends on how many windows you have, how many floors is up there. And I'm like, yeah. So to that point, I'd be willing to work with somebody and give them a core, but I would want to educate them as I go along to talk about the different categories. Know what the best sellers in the country are. So you got to have those. The cheeses that keep your lights on. Mozzarella, brie, Parmigiano Reggiano. I was taught that as a young cheesemonger. If you ever run out of that, you can't pay your bills. So you got to pay your bills first and get those cores in there. And you throw cheddar in there, of course. But then you have to layer in on top cheeses that are exciting and that set your business apart. Because if you're just having that comfortable cheese case set that you know is not going to create any shrink that you're happy with, you're not really pushing the envelope. You're not really trying to innovate. You're not really trying to expose your customers to more products and lift them up and make them happy. And besides having all those cheeses, you got to talk about how you're going to merchandise. It seems like to go back to your whole topic of the day, you know, so I know I keep talking about different categories. So besides merchandising, you got to get into the correct signage. You know, signage is going to be able to help you create that excitement that you have. If you have a beautiful case, let's say you have a bunker case and you want to have a bunker case full of American artisan cheeses, unless you put some American flags up there, put some signage, draw attention to it, the cheeses themselves may not be able to tell the story alone. They're going to need that help of being merchandised where they're not just shingled on top of each other. Like, what do you call that? Soldiering. I think some people call it in the merchandising world where you just lay stuff right on top of each other. I call it shingling, which can be interesting. But the thing, when you do that, people are the end consumer. You know, America's not the most food educated people in the world, you know, like Europeans, I feel like do a much better job of doing that. So they may not know cheese comes in a wheel, you know, and like a lot of cheeses, as silly as that sounds, they don't know that. They think cheese comes from a wall. It's a block that you get on a wall. But once you start putting cheese in a wheel and you start conveying that message, you're like, oh no, this is a real thing. This is cheese. This is how it comes. This is how it's made. It's got a story behind it. So that's number one for me. Recreate the shape of the wheel when you can. But intermingle more. I know some stores only recreate the shape of the wheel. That makes a lot of circles, which can be boring. So like put some shingles with recreating the shape of the wheels. Make it interesting. Put signage out there that'll help it pop. Add some samples and then teach your sales teams. Because whether you call them stockers or merchandisers, they're always a sales team. Whoever works in your store, their job is customer service. They are salespeople. Educate them to be able to talk about the product. And once you do that, you're ahead of the game.
I remember the moment where I realized that a customer did not know me at all. But at the point at which I told them what I liked, they were going to buy it. And I remember very distinctly thinking like, oh my gosh, I have so much power in this aisle right now. But it's true. And that's actually when you told me about your customer who has no shrink, I thought, oh, what a bummer, because a shrink is basically a way that you pull employees into the cheese case, right? You can choose to do all kinds of things with that, but you could break up those pieces of cheese, put them in your break room, and I will bet you anything the ROI on that will work itself out.
Absolutely.
Yeah, because you want people in the store to be able to talk about the products that you sell. I really like thinking about an artisan cheese case, and I love that you brought us back to this signage proposition. you told me that there are a lot of cheeses that need stories, and I believe that too. Now, what's your take on how much verbiage we can put on a sign that will really work?
I'm very particular about this. I'm glad you asked, because I've seen it all, especially with, you know, I'm even going back to my days of specifically independent cheese shops. You know, you don't have to be an independent cheese shop. You can be an independent store, but I've seen signs that were that blocked out the cheese case before, where signs are so big, if they're on like a 9x5 card, because you want to tell the exact story on that card, and then you can't really see the cheese and it becomes a signage case versus a cheese case. So there's a fine line there. And also, you got to be honest with yourself. And do you anticipate every cheese you having have a sign? Because that also could be a little bit overkill, where signage is that salesperson when your salesperson isn't around. So it's a positive thing. But if just like a pushy salesperson, just like somebody that just won't leave you alone and just up your grill and trying to get this sample to where you feel uncomfortable and want to walk away, the same thing can happen if you're over signage. So my point here is pick out the 1/3 of items and start there. What's the 1/3 of items that I feel like are special enough or maybe unknown enough where they're going to need that help? Think of it as they need a boost. They need a salesperson on there to help sell it because they have such a very special story because you spent a little extra money on it. Those are the ones that you want to push. And then get into a routine. What's on sale? If you don't have a sale cheese going on every day, that's something I taught all my stores. And then at the end of my cheesemongering days, I was running 350 shops across the country. And one of the initiatives that I put in was a cheese of the day. Just like not where cheeses go to die, not where that's all my markdown cheeses and all the cheeses that are about to be out of date, as customers catch on to that. But anything you're long on, anything you're overstocked, what is ripe right now? Maybe you have a cheese that is just absolutely sublime. And it's now is the time to sell it because you want to give your customers a product that's at its best. Or what I like to do too is with new employees or new sales team members, what's their favorite cheese? Sometimes what I get, especially like when we're trying to get somebody to do a demo for the first time, because I hate to say it, I'm going to be one of those grumpy old people. Young people don't know how to talk to people anymore, right? I gotta say it. But you can help prepare them to do that if you foster their happiness in food and say, what's your favorite cheese? If their favorite cheese is Havarti, by golly, let them get out on the floor sampling Havarti so that they can feel comfortable with something they know. And that when they talk about the cheese, that their authenticity comes through. And with that, they're going to feel a little more secure in their job. They're going to feel a little bit more secure being able to speak about cheese. And they're going to even like you a little bit more as a boss because you're not totally coddling them, but you're preparing them at a speed that they can handle. So you see how I tie merchandising and product selection in with training all at the same time because it all matters. You know, to me, it all matters. And a lot of times, I don't think retailers understand that you could have as much inventory in your cheese case as you do in your meat case. You know, and that's what I try to do to get the light bulb on for some people. I'm like, well, would you just let your butcher go and just, which is like, not educate people on the food that they're having and not walk your meat case and check for meat? The same amount of work goes into your cheese case. Thing is, vegetarians could also shop your cheese case, so you're more likely to get more customers.
Yeah. You get to see an enormous amount of stores in your job. Will you tell me about the last time you can remember being pleasantly surprised by someone's cheese merchandising?
Oh, that's a fun question. The short answer is, let's see. I don't do short answers. Yes. I was in Seattle. Yeah, great town. Love that town. Dungeness crab. Got me. I'm hooked. But I've been into a couple of stores, and I don't think I want to call out names right now, but I was in a store that they have roughly, I think, again, another 8 to 10 store chain, so a good smaller market. But they did a tremendous job with cheese. They had a wall. So I remember looking at their 5-deck. It was close to, sorry, I got to close my eyes while I envision all this. So you walk into the store, you walk into the bakery, and then you walk into a prepared food section, and to the right is a huge 5-deck wall that spans 24 feet at least. You know, it's a large 5-deck, and part of it is prepared foods and beverages. But as you're coming closer into where the actual cheese cutting and the small cheese case is, there's a five deck there that's all cheese. And because they have such limited coffin or bunker style cases going on, a lot of their product is actually on that five deck. But they move shelves around to make larger displays. They had a sweet grass dairy display. That's a farm in southern Georgia where they make a couple of cheeses. One of them is called Green Hill. And this just so happened to be like a Green Hill display. They got a little layer of fake grass, like long grass. And so they do it like inserted a little bit of like, but it looked good. It may sound horrible coming out of my mouth right now, but it looked really good where they put little false grass down, little miniature cows even on that grass. And then they had the cheeses stacked up. And I'm going to tell you, it caught my eye right away. And I was like, oh gosh, I know that cheese. And that was just one little small example. But all throughout that five deck, they made homes. They didn't just merchandise. They made homes for displays for different cheeses that they were trying to push. Green Hill was a new cheese for them. So they opened up and gave it a whole shelf, but built a display all around it. And customers were walking up because it draws people in. You know, merchandising still works. I feel like some people look past merchandising, but once you dedicate some space and let your teams get creative, because something else I could tell, besides a good sign, it was handwritten, but it looked like there was some personality from the store team members that was intertwined in that display. So besides having a cool display that you can go to, the cheesemonger that worked there had a heck of a lot of pride. And they were enjoying where they were working because they had the freedom to show, well, what they could do, and they were doing well. Then I got some good customer service besides that, but that's the last time. And it wasn't that long ago. That was just a few months ago. But that really stuck out.
I mean, I think your fake grass sounds fantastic. Little cows sound cool. You're right. It drew your eye, but like in the same way that you compare it to a meat case that adds some of that like kale and leafy green, like in between the trays, et cetera, like just draws your eye a little bit more intensely than something that's a little bit more, I guess, sterile in that space, right? Yeah, fantastic. Dairy too. Love to see them coming from Georgia all the way to the Pacific Northwest. Very cool. Do you remember when Beamster was like giving people those big blue cows?
Yes.
The store I was working in for a long time, even though it was kind of silly, we put galoshes on the cow and we gave it a cute little cape and kind of put it next to the cheese case. And parents were bringing kids into the stores that would like pose with the cow and the whole thing. So as silly as some of those ideas are, you never know what's going to appeal to a customer. And really, to your point, all you really want to do is get their attention. And if that's a little plastic cow, fantastic. Rock the little plastic cow.
But the whole thing about this too is whether it's a plastic cow or the grass, the one thing that's kind of underlying of what we're discussing here is everything that does, it makes cheese more approachable. One thing you don't need to do in your stores is continue with any idea that cheese is snooty, that it's, you know, too gourmet. There is gourmet, I'm not going to knock it, but like that it's unachievable for some people. Cheese is out there for everybody. And I find if you make it a little kitschy, a little bit fun, you make it more accessible for all of your customers, because you're going to have some customers. Yeah, they got all the money in the world. They're going to buy your most expensive wine, your most expensive cheeses, and that's great. But you have some customers, and I literally watch, and some customers, they love cheese, but they tiptoe around the cheese case because they're intimidated, because they don't know. And maybe if your merchandising is too sterile and cold, that comes across and really shares a message that, you know what, this is a proper cheese case. Only the richest can shop here. I was like, no, everybody could shop here. Put some fake grass out there. Put some little cows. Cheese is for everybody. Sorry, I get a little too far into that.
Oh, no, it's so good. Love the accent. You know, Anna would have said like a little bit pinkies up there. And it's true, you know, wine and cheese tend to be these categories where people are intimidated, where, you know, it's like, I think for me, I'll just use wine as the example. You know, it's like, I just picked one grape and then tried really hard to get as educated as I could about the one grape just so that I wouldn't be overwhelmed about it. And you know what? Like, even going back to that cheddar conversation, there are some phenomenal cheddars that American artists and cheesemakers have taken an enormous amount of effort to produce. They are beautiful, wonderful cheeses. And just because cheddar is kind of a ubiquitous varietal does not mean that you could not like decide that you had a couple of awesome cheddars just to like get you into a cheese case, right?
Exactly.
Nathan, I have so enjoyed all of your insights today. I'd like to wrap this up just by asking you, you know, when I was like, hey, Nathan, come on my podcast and talk to me about cheese merchandising. Was there anything that you felt like you wanted to talk about today that we did not touch on?
I've got one thing that I love, and just to share what we do a little bit at GFI with our team members. We have field reps and merchandiser reps that are out there that I've been able to work with for seven years now. So we work together and we have meetings every year. Every year we have some sales meetings. And one of the funnest things we did recently is we had a merchandising competition. We pulled together products at our warehouse. So all our team members came to our warehouse in Decatur and we pulled together a bunch of product. I broke up all the reps, the merchandisers into teams. And they merchandise different areas of the warehouse to put up cheese displays. After, of course, I gave an awesome class.
I love it.
But the point is, like, we go out, we care a lot about our producers. We care a lot about our customers and our team members. If we say we're going to have a team member out there to merchandise and help you to lift up your stores, know that they've gone through a training and even a competition and are really excited about putting their hands on products to make sure that they can make it look beautiful for the end consumer to take home.
I love that. And I have so much respect for both you and what you do. And just like the whole high touch nature of understanding that it is a symbiotic relationship between the distributor and the retailer. We are working together to do the same thing. And oftentimes, like in the sense of, you know, even thinking about really small cheese producers, like we're keeping family farms in the United States alive and thriving. And this is like phenomenally fantastic work. So Nathan, thank you so very much. That was insightful, amazing. And you know what you got? An invitation back to this podcast, because nice. I can tell that there is definitely more we can learn from you. Absolutely. Really, really appreciate your time today. Thank you so very much for joining us. That's it for this episode of The Buyer's Desk. Stay tuned for next week, where Chris talks to our promotions and merchandising specialists about, you guessed it, merchandising. Looking forward to seeing you then. Take care. Bye-bye. Hey, it's Angela. I'm here with Chris tasting some Bear Maple Farms sparkling ginseng tonics.
Yeah, and we got some really great flavors. We have a yuzu citrus, ginger citrus, and lemongrass mint. And we just cracked them open, but I'm going to crack open another.
Yeah, the satisfying sound of the can popping. I know we each had kind of a little bit of a difference of favorite. Felt like they all had a really lovely, gentle bubble. Little nuanced flavor. Remind me what you liked best, Chris?
I loved the lemongrass mint. I liked all of them. That the maple water had that hint of like a maple sweetness without being overpowering like a sugar. It even says only 1 gram of sugar on the can. The flavors are really subtle, really great. I think we said it's kind of that balance in between like a sparkling water and a soda. It's on the probably closer to the sparkling water end, where it's not too intense and punchy, but it's got really great flavor.
I was impressed with all three. I'm gonna go ahead and double down on the ginger citrus. And I just felt like there were so many amazing things about this. The can has so much information. We almost just didn't have enough time to go through all the amazing attributes.
Yeah, but I loved it. I think it's going to be a staple in my fridge. So you guys check this out. And buyers out there, if you haven't brought it into your store, at least ask for samples and get to try it and maybe put it on your shelves.
Cheers.
Cheers.
As we wrap up this episode of The Buyer's Desk, we'd like to extend our heartfelt thanks to the incredible Infra staff, contributors, dedicated independent retailers, and visionary natural food brands and business partners that made this episode possible.
Stay tuned for more inspiring insights and stories in the world of natural food retail. Until next time, thank you for your support. Angela Bozo, co-host and administrator.
Chris Sorensen, co-host and producer.
Kim Rout, executive producer and segment contributor.
Jim Olson, Spin's segment manager.
Austin Hinkle, audio engineer.
Sarah Super, wellness strategist.
Madeline Ware, marketing writer, editor, and digital manager.
Haley Craig, outreach manager.
Raina Kittredge, segment contributor.
Bella Sislo, outreach manager and segment contributor.